Hello, non-pro listeners, and in another exciting episode dictated to us by our fans.
Woo!
In the non-pro fan club. That's where you're supposed to woo. Give me another woo.
Woo!
Thank you. Today we will be talking about superhero movies and taking names and filling out checks. You know,
and like chewing bubblegum.
Chewing bubblegum and then popping out wheelies. We're going to be talking about superhero movies, specifically how to define success in superhero movies. I'm Frank, joined in studio by Al, James, and Pete. And safe to say, we're all a bunch of geeks.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, speak for yourself, man. No, I'm kidding.
You're the biggest geeks in the world. But I don't know if that matters anymore when it comes to superhero movies and the like, because I think we've reached the age about 5 years ago where superhero movies are now mainstream successful. They're everybody goes to see these things. I remember back in the day, and this is where we would have sound effects if we already didn't screw up production.
Back then.
We could do that. We could definitely do that. When basically it was almost impossible to get a comic book or a superhero product in front of people. And then they often really, really sucked. They were just terrible. But that's not the case anymore. Now it's only occasionally terrible. And often it's bank for big production companies.
Mm-hmm. It's an exciting time to be into nerd culture. Geek is chic. You know, we've said it here before. And I think superhero movies are just one admittedly big part of that.
Mm-hmm. There's also the flip side of that, which is like we're now entering the superhero Western phase. You know, when there was a time when all movies Hollywood put out were Westerns, and then people were like, enough of the Westerns, and then the Westerns went away. That's your film 101.
Well, it could be that it's just going to be a new genre that kind of sticks around. Like, Westerns are still made, just the science fiction films are still made, so it's entirely possible that superhero films will go the way of other genre films and just become less prevalent but always be there.
I don't know. And obviously, none of us are smart enough to tell you the answer to this, and that's not what you pay us for. You paid us here to do this here podcast about what we think we can use to define success in superhero movies. And I think there are a bunch of different metrics you could think of, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's just about the filthy lucre.
Filthy Is that lucre? What we're calling it now?
Yeah, the filthy lucre. Not the character from the...
Jane Austen's Mafia?
Not the character from that. But
the real movie.
I believe you. I'm not doubting you on this.
Was it based on a comic book property?
It was not, sadly. So no, we can't talk about it.
We are legally denied the ability to talk.
Was The Godfather a comic book?
No.
They did not make a comic book.
No, there was a book about The Godfather. There wasn't a comic book.
I think so. I think the novelization was done by Mario Puzo.
Yeah, yes. And he was a failed comic book writer. This is all true. You're getting a lot of film history on this podcast.
Well,
yeah,
it's a really. Film podcast. So.
Yeah, well, to share some film numbers, I mean, you know, we're talking 11. That it's not all about the money, but the top 10, three of the top 10 films, top 10 highest grossing films of all time right now are superhero movies.
Oh.
They're both of the Avengers films and Iron Man 3. So they're all superhero movies and they're only held by Marvel.
Wait, wow.
The Avengers and Iron Man 3?
Two Avengers movies and Iron Man 3 are the top three grossing films of all time. Are in the top. I'm sorry. There were so many. James really did pull out the tricky math on this.
Avengers is the highest one at the fifth highest grossing film of all time.
Interesting. Hey, can we just do this because this is now a film podcast? Can you talk to us about what the top five are? Or actually what the top 10 are? We have time for that, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Infinite time. Yes. You don't care, podcast listeners.
The highest grossing film.
Do it in reverse order, which means 10 to 1. Okay. 1 being the most grossing.
Well, 10 is Iron Man 3.
Oh, okay.
This is going to be some kind of
number 9
stupid ass math. I can't. 10 is Iron Man 3. Got it.
10 is Iron Man 3.
9.
Number 9 is Frozen.
Okay. Wow.
Okay. Number 8 is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Yeah.
Number 7 is The Avengers Age of Ultron.
Can we stop on Harry Potter for a minute? Who went to watch 2 multiple times, but not one part one of the you don't have to answer that. You don't know, and I don't care. I do care.
I'm betting there's something changed in the inflation math.
Well, you think it was in like high, super high definition?
Keep in mind, everything here on this list, except for one, is in the post 3D craze, $12 to $20 tickets, blah, blah, blah.
And none of this is adjusted for inflation or anything. No, so we're not going to see Gone with the Wind.
For inflation will always be Gone with the Wind. It's just, it will always like be gone, really with, gone with the Wind.
Weird math. On
well,
that
I can part. Explain to you the math of that. Holy crap. But we're not gonna do that.
We'd
on
be
this
here all
podcast.
Night.
We might do it later. Because I want to know.
Number six is actually the newest Fast and the Furious movie, Fast and the Furious 7.
We laugh about that. I don't know why, because those are like really well received movies.
Everyone I know
loves it.
I saw it in French.
I have not seen them, and I feel like I'm missing out. Me too.
Number five is the Avengers.
Right.
Okay. Number four is Jurassic World.
Oh, wow.
Number three is Star Wars Episode 7.
Okay. All right. I'm getting to understand this list.
Number two is the only film on here, like I said, that doesn't calculate 3D. And it's a really a testament to it. No, it's a James Cameron's Titanic at number two.
I'm kind of sad about that.
Hold on.
I caveat that.
All right.
Because I think I know this list.
Yeah.
And it is. Because it includes the numbers from the 3D re-release.
Oh. I'm going to say, though, Titanic was one of those films that
it played beyond its Oscar.
It played in theaters well beyond its Oscar. It definitely, it's in there. It deserves the numbers.
Earned it, but yeah. It does beat Avengers because of...
It might be in there about this.
I'm genuinely surprised there wasn't a Titanic comic that came out at that time. And also, I heard Jane Austen's Titanic, which would have been amazing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know it.
Thank you. Number one is also James Cameron and his Avatar.
No, right. I'm really disappointed with those first two.
I really want to see four more of that.
So whenever you wonder why movies keep coming out with 3D re-releases or whatever, this is why. Because every movie in this list had some sort of weird 3D IMAX.
And can I just add something here?
Yeah.
I am amazed that the longest running film of all time is not on there.
Which would be?
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
So... I've checked into this. The shadow cast and things like that don't count in the same way, numbers-wise, as theatrical screenings. It's a different set of licensing rentals that you have to do to license the film for a full-on screening and license it for your shadow cast. It's something they created actually for the Rocky Horror Picture Show to make it easier for people to get their hands on.
Interesting.
But because of that, it's not calculated like this.
Harm.
But it does still count as being in continuous release.
It is, yes. I mean...
It depends on what
matrix you're using, I'd give it that.
So we've got three in the top 10 are Marvel movies or comic book movies. Obviously, comic book movies are big budget, and that's talking about these super high grossing films. If you're just talking about, bank for a production company, I think every year for the last few years, some of the highest grossing films of that production company came from a comic book property. So Warner Brothers is, I think, largely banked in many ways from their superhero movies. Marvel/Disney does get a lot of its money from
it. I was going to say, I'm pretty sure Marvel Studios gets all their money from superhero movies.
Yeah, that one art house piece that Marvel put out that was just a documentary about Stan Lee animated by...
Nope. You lost the joke.
Corn Howl? I don't know.
That was Ang Lee's Hulk.
No. All right.
Ang Lee's Hulk?
I had a couple of jokes in there, but I couldn't decide on which animator I wanted to go with.
And then I ruined
it. We're not going to go back and revisit that. We're not going to cut it out of the podcast either.
You're welcome, everyone.
I'll let that hang like a terrible, terrible thing. All right. Anyways, so a lot of these, the big production companies make a lot of their bank on these movies, even if it's not the most highest grossing film of the existence of film. So I think... one of the things that kind of brought this to our attention and the reason why the people in our fan club wanted us to talk about it was probably Batman versus Superman. Or is it Superman versus Batman?
It's Batman versus Superman.
Oh, guess who gets top billing? The Bat. Because the Bat basically sells tickets for Warner Brothers.
It's alphabetical order.
With the exception of like The Dark Knight, which was the first, no Batman movie like they always had his name in it. They were always like, they led with the fact that Batman's in this film. You need to give us your money. And I think that's probably what happened to this film as well. But it was a film that was, let's say, not necessarily well received by critics and by fans, considering those two separate pools of people.
Yeah.
Critics did not necessarily like it. They thought the pacing was, there were issues with it. I think the Rotten Tomatoes score on it was a thing that was low. I don't know. I'm hoping somebody who has access to a computer could look that up.
Yeah. Rotten Tomatoes score for Batman v Superman for critics right now is at 28%. It's 320 reviews.
That's a lot.
89 of them are fresh, and 231 of them are matrixed as rotten.
And these are critics.
These are critics.
Labeled as critics by the Rotten.
What
audience? Yeah. Audience percentage is a little higher. It's like 69%, but it's still like audience levels for something like this tend to inflate high.
Yeah.
You know, towards the better, and 69% is kind of low for even for an audience.
And
rating.
I want to say this.
I just see Henry Cavill sitting at his computer all day, upvoting it.
Well, I think this is part of the like chip on people's shoulders, right? Because I don't think anybody, if you listen to like archived episodes of Near Mint when Man of Steel came out. I was not a fan of Zack Snyder's Man of Steel. No. I did not. I was not looking forward to this movie. In fact, I haven't seen it yet. So take that with a grain of salt. And I'm not here to rehash whether or not the movies are good or not. But to suggest that fans didn't like the movie basically closes your eyes to how much money the movie made. And the fact that 69% of people who are reviewing it favorably. So I think a different kind of fan that perhaps that you think you are did enjoy the film. So it of course begs the question of how do we define success? Financial success is iffy. So on the one hand, you want to make a movie that makes back its budget, obviously, and makes enough of a profit for the company where they feel like, yeah, this can be built off. And that's why franchises have become such a big deal for movie companies is because it's not just the success of that one film, but can that spin off into other films that would make them even more money?
Yeah.
With Batman versus Superman, I'm not exactly sure how that thing went.
The Matrix isn't... The problem with Batman versus Superman is definitely DC's most expensive film. It might be the most expensive film, period, ever. There are rumors, and Warner Brothers hasn't released their full cost of making the movie, but that... It comes out to about $410 million to make Batman v Superman, which...
That seems a little high.
It is a little high. There's only one other movie that kind of hits that area, and it's actually Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides was like $410.6 million.
All right. Well, that was a lot high then.
Was that mostly the casting in that film?
I don't have the breakdown for that.
Let's say it was mostly trying to get the dog back.
Yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of that. So that being said, Batman v Superman has made, I lost my tab here, has made $312,778,000.
This is not how numbers work.
It's made like $315 million.
All right, that's pretty damn good. So it almost made
it's not
bank back.
It's by no means terrible. It's by no means
flop
failure. But they definitely aren't going to make all their money back, and that's not considering marketing. Now, obviously, Warner Brothers here is a bigger play with Batman v Superman being kind of the first movie to really open up their universe. I'm going to say Man of Steel really wasn't that movie, but. You know, it's concerning when you have something like, like that drop off so quickly.
Opening weekend was high, and then the previous weeks.
Yeah, so opening weekend was ballers, breaking records for pre-orders and amount of people in seats, and people were just super excited. As Pete said, you have Batman and Superman in a movie together. If these are your guys, if this is what you've always wanted to see, you were going. It didn't matter.
Right.
But in the next weekend, it went from $82 million to $37 million, which is a 55% drop-off.
Nice.
The record holder for drop-off is the new Fantastic Four movie.
Oh, man.
At 48%.
Whoa.
I'm wondering what percentage of the opening weekend sales were pre-orders.
How many
people pre-ordered tickets for Batman versus Superman before they had any idea what the movies or initial critical reactions were.
I couldn't guarantee you, but it was a lot. They had a record breaking. I think it's the highest movie in pre-sale tickets, beating out Star Wars.
Wow.
So,
all right. Well, we don't want to just focus on the negative here, or just focus on beating up Batman Superman, which right. I guess Lex Luthor did that. If you saw the movie, I'm just guessing. I don't really know. but there are, of course, many different metrics we can use to determine whether or not a superhero movie is successful to you.
Right.
One of the things we came up with, I think, that's pretty neat is, and for me personally, it's the number one of the most important things is innovation. So again, when I was a kid, I would be shocked to find out that so many superhero properties have made it to the big screen. Back in my day, they often just sucked or went straight to video or something along those lines, made for TV movies.
Right.
You know, they were not really well made. So when I look back at the movies that are most important to me, and it may seem weird to think of this as innovation, but I'm thinking of the original Superman movie, 1978 Superman movie, because it showed that you can do this. To some, I would say the 89's Batman would be a similar, but not necessarily for me. For whatever reason, that never did it to me. So it was Superman for me, and believe it or not, it's kind of tied out the gate. Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, and X-Men, Bryan Singer's X-Men,
absolutely
showed that you can make good superhero movies. And that to me was shocking. It was innovative. I couldn't fathom it. It was really, really neat. And I think related to that as well is, and it's going to sound odd, but Iron Man. So when the original Iron Man came out, I was not interested. I did not want to see this movie. Yeah, I think Pete, you and I saw it together in its premiere back in New Brunswick. And I was just sort of along with everybody else who went to go see the movie. I was like, I don't know. It's a movie about a warmonger. It was probably going to be like some overarching story about, you know, like a veiled reference to the actual wars we were in. I didn't think it was appropriate for a comic book movie. Didn't want to see it, but it was a lot of fun. It was a good movie, great movie, you know, enjoyable. But I give it innovative because of that ending, which was effectively a gag. You know, and yeah. Let's have Sam Jackson show up in his Ultimates version of Nick Fury and, you know, wink and nod about the Avengers initiative. It was in most ways just a throwaway gag at the end of the movie, but it was amazing because it made it feel like this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my measures of success.
I mean, I think if we're talking about superhero movies as a genre for success, as much as I love those movies you mentioned that really, I think, define it, you know, and with the exception of Iron Man here, you know, so movies like Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, you know, and X-Men, I think it's, to me, it was walking out of movies that I said that was legitimately excellent in all shapes and sizes. Movies like The First Iron Man or The Dark Knight, you know, movies that I can walk out of and say, like, that's not a movie that I'm going to recommend just to, you know, my friends who are into the genre. This is a movie I will recommend to people who love film, who love direction.
So it's a well-made movie.
But I feel like the Superman movie, the original one, definitely applies to that, especially for the time it took place in. It, like, you look at the way, like, America kind of was that place in time, it really needed a film like that. And it's sort of, not only is it like a very good time capsule for what we needed in that era of American history, but like that tagline of, you know, you will believe a man can fly, like, doesn't just speak about visual effects. It speaks about the concept of, in that film, they made you believe Superman was able to fly. And it, I mean, they're dated effects now, but it was more than that. The film made you believe it.
Verisimilitude was like one of the things that Richard Donner put up on like the set when they were making the film. He said just the appearance of realism, like you can believe this can happen. I think we may be talking about a bunch of different but related things. I wouldn't say that Superman the movie was necessarily like, this is, if you like film, you will enjoy this film. I think if you like a very specific film, and Richard Donner was perfect for directing that specific kind of film, you definitely enjoy that. Just like if you like Westerns, you might enjoy a John Ford Western.
Mm-hmm.
So I think definitely that could be the case. But I also think that in a broader sense, and I think this actually almost goes right up against mainstream success, is you can make a movie that's just good for everyone. And for me, something like that would be Ant-Man, right?
Yeah.
You could go, yeah. I could bring someone to see Ant-Man that has no interest in either the Marvel Cinematic Universe or like comic book movies in general, and it was fun, it was exciting, it was a spy thriller with like a little bit of a weird sci-fi element to it. That is another aspect. That to me is mainstream success. You could sell it to anybody.
Well, Marvel has done a really great job. So back when in the early 2000s, the superhero movie was a genre, right? Mm-hmm. Marvel has made it their goal to transcend the idea that the superhero movie is a genre and say that no, movies with superheroes in them fit in two genres. The Captain America, The Winter Soldier is a spy thriller, you know, Ant-Man as a heist film. You know, this is definitely looking at the superhero comic as a medium in a much broader sense, which is something they're going to have to if they need to stick around.
I agree completely. Or want to stick around. I think overall, for the most part, straight superhero films aren't that great. They're not that interesting. But when you have superhero movies that are other movies, the taut political thriller, the war movie, Captain America First Avenger.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The period piece kind of element, yeah.
Yeah. Fantasy with the Dark World, Thor the Dark World.
Mm-hmm.
And Thor, I guess, was pretty much a straight superhero movie.
No, I would say it's a Shakespearean.
It's a very fish out of water Thor? Film.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the flavor of that film was from like the high fantasy, not that it was a high fantasy setting, but that Kenneth Branagh directed it. And I'm like, yeah. I get why they got Kenneth Branagh for this.
I think also a sign of really making it is seeing other films dissecting your genre. I mean, films like Super or Unbreakable, you know, films that tackle the superhero idea in a different way or are dissecting it in a way. I mean, you know, Super was directed by James Gunn, and Super, the way he dissected the superhero movie was one of the things that landed him the job doing Guardians of the Galaxy.
All right. You know? I can respect that. It's weird. I feel like holding up a mirror to a genre and dissecting it, like you said, isn't necessarily what for me counts as success. And it's not that I'm not a big film nerd. It's just that I feel like it could also be really reductive. Like for example, I don't know if Watchmen did it the same way the Watchmen comic book did it for me.
I don't think it did at all.
The Watchmen comic book really did make me re-examine comics. But the Watchmen movie was just like, all right, this is just a bunch of pastiches you threw together and made a movie.
But I think there's a little bit of a difference between the examples I named and the example you gave, which I agree with you 100%. I don't think Watchmen does it as much as I kind of like the attempt that was made, and I think it is visually very stunning. But the films that I made are both originals, right? So they are made as movies to dissect the superhero movie, not an adaptation of a comic that was dissecting other comics.
That's interesting. Mm. Maybe I haven't seen enough of those, because the ones I'm thinking of Hancock, which again fell short for me. I feel like a lot of them do fall short for
me.
I'll
agree with you. I feel like that was, I think the only problem with Hancock really is though that it sort of fell off in the halfway point of the film. I think the beginning of that film is absolutely fascinating and really does a good job with it and seemed very innovative at the when it started, and it just sort of lost. I think it ran out of ideas.
Top heavy,
yeah.
The first half of the film is the part of the film that I think does a lot of the dissecting, and the second half of Hancock kind of resolves it into just a normal kind of
superhero film. Yeah,
I mean, you know, a lot of these kind of films fall into cult status, and one of the ones that I think does it really well, I know, is a favorite of yours.
Yeah. So another thing that we can use, and I guess as a metric for success would be if the film is a cult status. It doesn't matter whether it fits any of the other the areas we talked about or the ones we're going to bring up next. Cult status is just like you love this film no matter what. I think Mystery Men is, for me, the key. So Mystery Men as a comic property is vague. It's like part of Flaming Carrot. I vaguely remember them maybe in an issue of The Tick. I don't even remember how I read anything about the Mystery Men. I think they were just vaguely, like, they were just mentioned in comics. But as a superhero movie, it was great for me because it's infinitely quotable. It's got, it's my own group. You know, we watch it a lot. We watch it. We could watch it once a year and enjoy all those elements of it. And I think certain films, regardless of whether they were popular or made a lot of money or if they did anything quote unquote right, you get them so that they were just well done.
It's fascinating. You look at that film and like that, the list of actors in that film is incredible. Like it's Ben Stiller. Well, like, when he was like just starting to get incredibly popular.
Right.
Jeffrey Rush is the villain in that film.
That's right.
I mean, it's just, I mean, you go over.
Eddie Izzard is in there.
Eddie Izzard,
Paul
my
Rubens,
God.
The return of Paul Rubens.
Yeah.
God. And
the incomparable William H. Macy.
I was That's about right. to say William H.
Hank
Macy.
Hank Azaria got top billing in that film.
Yeah.
Which mm-hmm. was, you wouldn't have expected it, but makes
but he,
a lot
but he
of
was
sense.
Huge. He was in a lot of films.
He was in a lot of films, but they were usually like secondary roles, B roles.
Yeah. Was that right around when Tuesdays with Maury came out?
It's possible. We were trying to think about this beforehand. We think it might just be a budget thing because William H. Macy and a lot of these people made it big afterwards. But at the time, I think just with the amount of money he was making on The Simpsons, he got top billing. And I'm not sure, but like everybody, Kel
Mitchell,
Kel Mitchell's in this. So many comedians have either walk on like minor roles or major roles in this thing.
Did you know? And I'm just looking at
Jimmy
it here.
Garoppolo,
yeah.
Michael Bay has a walk on role. Michael Bay is in this movie.
Oh yeah, he is actually.
I forgot this.
But yeah, he's in this movie.
Is Tom Waits in this?
Yeah, I think so.
Tom Waits is in this.
Tom Waits is in it. He's Dr. Heller.
Okay, yeah. This is such a ridiculous, like, why are all these musicians and comedians getting together and making a superhero movie before? Like, I understand why it would be made now, because superheroes movies are so popular and so great, but I have no idea why it was made.
It's
hey, you want to be in this superhero movie with
Dane
Lee Herman?
Dane Cook's in it.
Dane Cook has a walk-on role as the Waffler.
Yeah,
yep, it's just...
Okay, I think that's clear. Do you guys have cult... favorite films that you think it doesn't matter, it's just I love them.
You know what I really liked that nobody else likes? I really liked the Green Hornet film, the remake.
That's a good one.
Nobody,
that is a good example.
Nobody likes that film. It's definitely considered like a bad superhero movie, but I thought the direction was interesting.
Yeah.
It's certainly, it's a different, it's not the not the original Green Hornet character in any way, shape, or form, but I enjoyed what it was for what it was. It was interesting. I thought Seth Rogen and it just... I don't know. It just came together in a right way for me. And I think that's also a big thing with me for films. I don't want to ever take away from somebody if they really enjoy something. I know I have a friend who just loves a film that I utterly despise. But, you know, I give it to her every time because if that film...
Yeah, if you like it, don't
crap on people's
joy.
If you like it, why am I going to crap on it? If that means something to you, that's important and that's what the medium of film is supposed to do.
I got head shakes from Pete. What was that about?
You liked Your Highness too, didn't you?
I did not like Your Highness. No, that was not good.
Pineapple Express was amazing though.
Pineapple Express was great.
But I think that's a good example.
I can see where the love for that film comes from. It's like, it's. I really wanted that movie to be, for me to fall in love with it. Like, I feel like it drowned itself in the joke too hard. Like, where
a little bit. I don't disagree with you.
And the great thing about, like, Green Hornet was, like, Kato kind of went in, you know, kicked everybody around and won. And then, like, and, you know, Green Hornet would show up, like, great job, Kato, we make a great team. And that was the joke, was that was just the world that existed in. And that, like Kato would go in and, like... That was what was funny about it.
But the Green Hornet wasn't himself kind of incompetent, and they made him a little bit too much for the film. I can watch something and recognize its flaws, but that doesn't necessarily mean I didn't like it.
I agree with you. It was
funny.
Anybody
want to come up and say that the Green Lantern was their favorite movie?
I don't think there's anyone that's going to be able to say that.
I'm pretty darn sure that Ryan Reynolds like it.
Meteor Man? Do you guys remember Meteor Man?
I remember Meteor Man. Mm-hmm. It was a film, and I remember... like watching it like when I was, I don't think it was age appropriate.
Well, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't bad. Yeah. It was just like I had no idea what was going on because I was a kid. And I had the same thing with Blank Man. Actually, I had no idea what the heck was going on.
Blank
with that
Man
film.
Was maybe not age appropriate. No,
I had no idea what was going on with that film either. But they're both films. So it's like they're just superheroes. They kind of made like you watch Meteor Man. Like he has whatever power he decides to have at the moment.
It's interesting that stage of movie making because it's like the superhero movies again weren't very popular.
Yeah.
So they were just like, you know, superheroes, they're really cool. Comic books are great. I want to make this movie. And the amount of filmmakers who up until, again, Brian Singer, Sam Raimi, who just, and I want to give them so much credit for like, they followed through on their dreams and made it good. And everybody else before them who was like, we're going to do this. I don't care if nobody wants to see it. So there's a lot of films in there that
I can definitely say I think of a superhero movie that I find like I have might be called classics, Megamind. Like by
Megamind, the animated movie.
Yeah,
oh, all right.
I love that film, and I don't know why I love that film. Like, because I'm not the biggest kind of like Will Ferrell fan.
I was wondering. I was like, is it Will Ferrell or Steve Carell who does the voice?
No,
of
Will Ferrell. And I'm not really a big fan of Will Ferrell. But watching that movie and having Brad Pitt just be this like kind of schmaltzy hero, just says, yeah, I'm kind of done with this. Like, kind of like retires and says. I just don't want to do it. I feel trapped in my, like, it was that weird, cool Superman dilemma I always kind of wanted to see put to film, where it was like, no, if I'm going to go read self-help books and realize that, like, I'm not trapped in my own, like, what I can do sort of thing. If I don't want to save people, I don't have to.
That's neat.
Like, and I kind of, like, really liked that, like, the plot of that film, and it was like, I don't know, it's goofy and it's awesome in its own stupid way.
Basically the plot of Superman, the Man of Steel. Two.
No, I think it's the opposite.
With great power comes no perceptible responsibility.
There was a great Superman comic where at one point, I think in the future, Superman does spend a lot of time on the moon reading, I think, self-help books or like just reading, just getting back to reading. I don't remember if that's actually true, if I imagined it. But I would say, okay, I'm going to say it. I'm going to throw it out there for since we're talking about cult status as a reason the film is great. Howard the Duck. I really enjoyed Howard the Duck as a kid. It was goofy fun. It was ridiculous. There was an animatronic duck, which wasn't animatronic, not completely. I guess his face was animatronic. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of... All right, so Howard the Duck was the new Coke of comic book movies. I don't know how to describe this. It was like, it came with so much fanfare, so much ridiculous fanfare. I guess mostly on the back of George Lucas.
Yeah.
Because it couldn't have been because, oh, comic book brought to life because those weren't successful yet.
No.
Although I guess maybe it was just right after Superman Returns and people were like maybe hopeful that comic book movies would be a thing when they can milk for money. But it was just such a weird tanking that I think... it holds a place in my heart.
Didn't Lucas do that like right after Return of the Jedi?
It was something like Lucas was on a streak that would definitely paint the rest of his career for the next year.
So
a few years.
First off, keep in mind, people give Lucas credit with directing Howard the Duck, but he did not.
No,
George Lucas is an
executive producer.
Yeah, he was just one of the executive producers, although obviously he had a big push with Howard the Duck. He was very involved. It was Industrial Light and Magic developing all the, all the
effects.
The effects and stuff, but... it was Willard Huck, I think.
Well, that explains a lot.
Who directed it. And I'd like to point out that he is... this was it. This was his chance.
He
didn't
and only
do
thing.
Anything else. He worked as second units on a lot of George Lucas's best films, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
All right, cool.
American
like
Graffiti.
I will crowdsource this guy's next film. I liked Howard the Duck, and that's what I count as a success.
Star Wars.
Going back to our list, we skipped a couple of really good points of what makes a movie, a superhero movie, good for you. Let's get straight to getting it right. So, clearly, Howard the Duck may not have gotten it right.
I think it missed a few marks.
Yeah, I get that. I don't know many Howard the Duck fans, or I didn't at the time, but I could see how you'd be like, this is not the irreverent, in-your-face, underground comic that I grew up to love.
Right.
But there are some movies that do it, like, you give them credit just because they did such a wonderful job. For me, Batman Begins is the number one on the list. Getting it right is important. At that time... I brought up Batman 1989, right? Mm-hmm. I brought up that version, and I said that didn't do it for me for innovation. Although anybody else who I've ever talked about, like the movie that made you think a comic book movie would be good, Batman comes up as often as Superman does. And then actually Spider-Man people tend to forget, even though there was a huge gap there when superhero movies sucked.
Yeah.
I don't bring up Batman 89 because for whatever reason, I never liked it as a kid. I just didn't. It was okay at best.
Just real quick, I just want to interject why Batman 89 was so important and such a major thing for successful comic book movies is because it was really one of the first ones, certainly the first really notable one, that proved that superhero movies didn't have to be a joke.
They weren't
serious, adult, and, you know, dark.
And this is actually one of my reasons for not liking it, because I remember at the time thinking that this isn't serious. Mm-hmm. This is ridiculous. This is really like, I mean, there's a clown as the villain, and it's gothic. I didn't have the terminology probably at the time. But it's not like people keep saying that it was serious or that it was dark, and I'm like, it was campy. There was something else. Like if you watch Gotham now on television, you know, you get the whole, this isn't quite camp. This isn't Batman 66 television show camp. But at the same time, no one's looking at this and being like, oh my God, it's like holding a mirror up to society. It's ridiculous in its own way. And I think I was maybe swayed by, if not friends, family at the time. I think my older sisters told me right away that it was terrible. And for whatever reason, that stuck. I remember them saying it sucked. And I was like, all right, it sucks. And that never happened again. I never took their advice. But for whatever reason, Batman 89 never really hit it for me. And the reason I bring this up is because for me, Batman Begins wasn't just a redemption from the
Batman and Robin,
the Joel Schumacher versions of Batman,
right?
That eventually got really off script, but it was also like, yeah, that's the Batman I want to see. I really want to see the real gritty, realistic, bleak kind of Batman that Christian Bale's Batman performance provided.
I think Batman Begins is my favorite of the three, even though I think The Dark Knight might be overall a better film. There's just something about the perfect balance of the way Batman is presented in Batman Begins. I just really like.
I have a really interesting view on Batman Begins because somehow at that time it completely flew under my radar. Huh. I had no idea that there was a Batman movie being made.
Interesting.
The first time I heard about it, I was in a theater for a screening of The Passion of the Christ. And this trailer comes on for this boring movie with Christian Bale. Hey, I'm pretty sure that's the guy from Newsies.
If anybody else were talking, I would be like, you probably didn't recognize him, but no, he would have recognized him.
Wandering around the Himalayas and
Newsies too.
Learning martial arts. And I'm like, I don't care about this at all. And then the bats came out and we got the Batman logo and you find out it's Batman Begins. And all of a sudden I was hooked.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what that says about it. I think, because it was a movie I was completely uninterested in. I had no interest in that genre of film at all.
That is interesting.
But when I found out that it was a superhero movie, that it was Batman,
like, all in.
And they were taking this completely novel approach to a superhero movie. It wasn't a superhero movie. It was that kind of movie. It was a martial arts, a dark kind of.
But like it wasn't that kind of movie because it wasn't like.
Well, it ended Christian, up not quite being that.
Yeah,
but he was sold even when he thought
it was. I was like, okay, this is a new spin on a superhero movie. It's exactly what Frank was saying before with innovation.
Yeah, yeah,
I ended up loving the movie.
So this might be off topic for a second, but I am so happy to know I am not the only one who didn't know that movie was coming out, right? And I'm a movie guy.
Yeah.
I was following movies at the time, and a friend of mine was like, the new Batman movie's coming out next week.
Did
I'm
you
like,
watch what?
I honestly think that and this is kind of related, although I think these next two categories are actually very much related, but like the Schumacher movies were, and in his defense, I've said this before, he owns it. He's like, yeah, I just didn't get Batman apparently. But the Schumacher movies were so bad, I think people were like, we don't need to know about what the next movie is coming out. related to that would be the redeeming a franchise. So again, getting it right, redeeming a franchise, those are two closely related things, although specifically with redeeming a franchise, you had to have been really disappointed in some earlier iteration of this character or film, and then now you're like, this is successful even if it makes no money because they got it right and they redeemed it.
I think that there's a lot of different films that where that happens. Like, our most obvious one we have is Deadpool, which is the most it's that one that's just most recent.
So we just Deadpool first appeared in a Wolverine Origins.
Yeah,
the Wolverine. That's
X-Men
probably
Origins.
The title.
Oh, X-Men Wolverine. Origins Wolverine. Yeah.
No, Wolverine the Origins Wolverine. An X-Men story is the actual title of that film.
Right.
And it was a joke apparently, but not the kind that Deadpool would tell. And this latest movie is supposed to be amazing. I also haven't seen that yet. God,
it's a good film. It's a very good film.
And if you're talking about success, just to note, Deadpool is the highest box office for a rated R movie ever.
Wow,
that's insane! What?
Yeah.
It's
so people did not take the advice of not bringing their kids to see this.
It is number eight. It is number eight on the total of superhero movie box offices, and then it's like at $360 million.
I do want to point out, I've heard of a lot of people taking kids to see Deadpool, despite the warnings.
Yeah, fine, I'm cool with that.
I have not heard any stories, unlike Batman versus Superman, I have not heard any stories of people taking their kids to see Deadpool and then walking out in the first 10 minutes.
Wow. Al, you were talking about Deadpool.
But maybe on Deadpool, there's a lot of other films. Like, you could definitely say First Class was one of the films that...
X-Men First Class for me, because there was a... X-Men was really high up there, and then there were a couple films that just kept going, like, I don't know if I care about
the Wolverine origin, X-Men Origins,
Last Stand.
Last Stand.
But then First Class, I was like, you know what, I'll try. I did not enjoy it at all. I hated Last Stand. So when First Class came out, I was like, all right, you know what, I could totally ignore. And then what was the sequel to Last Class?
Days of Future Past.
Days of Future Past that brought Last Stand back into the family. I was like, you
sort of brought it out. Also,
yeah, but like it acknowledged it, and I'm like, you sirs and mandems and mutants, I don't know what I'm doing, are good at it.
I definitely say the one thing I liked the most about Days of Future Past was the idea that it basically said, like, we're just going to select what we think is canon out of those films.
Yeah,
like,
that's
fine. We'll accept A, B, and C from like Last Stand, but the rest of the movie doesn't necessarily have to have happened.
Which, by the way, is a prime example of getting it right.
that is comic booky.
Not even comic booky. That is dead on authentic X-Men. X-Men is like, stuff happened, but we'll just do whatever we want. Is Kitty Pryde dead? Who cares?
I have a really interesting one, if I can jump to getting it right for a second, because it doesn't have anything to relate to, but it's getting it right in 100% of the word. It's The Incredibles.
Okay, yeah.
The only good Fantastic
I'll
Four film.
That. Yeah.
Right? We've had three terrible Fantastic Four movies, but The Incredibles is just, that's it. I mean, that's getting the superhero family right. And they made it from the get-go. And it's just, it's perfect. That's getting it right. And it's weird to say that you're getting it right.
I think it's also innovative.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's got a cult status.
Yep.
It redeemed the franchise that was, I don't know, Cars? I don't know.
Pixar.
I'm sure.
One of the weird things...
I think we're wrapping up the podcast. This is a perfect place to end. I guess we could keep talking. Fine. Right.
I was still like, I think one of the odd things, like, to bounce off James, like, one of the things, like, we could say about First Class is, besides it being a redemption thing, is also it's one of those exceptions to the rule of getting it right, because I feel like a lot of that movie doesn't necessarily get the origins or who those characters are correct.
I think he's got
absolutely
that right.
Mystique is nothing like she is in the comic books in that film.
But she's still not even
the way she is in some of the earlier movies.
But she's really interesting in that film.
Exactly.
She's a good character.
So I think that getting it right, while fantastic to a certain degree,
right.
Sometimes like you take a
chance.
That's
redeeming a franchise. That's the difference.
I'm going to turn that around and say I disagree.
Okay.
Because there's... And I'm a weird person to be saying this, because I'm usually like Bible thumping. No, this is canon. this must be held to. But
yeah, I think Pete is intolerable.
Listen to Near Mint episodes. But seriously, I think getting it right does not necessarily mean being slavishly faithful to the source material in terms of character beats, exact translations of the character.
Mm-hmm.
It can also mean getting the spirit of it right.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true.
And I think in a lot of cases, some variation is necessary. But I think if you stay true to the spirit of the story, a lot of times, and you respect the source material, that's what, respect for it, not necessarily straight recreation, then you have potential for a good movie.
And I think that's true, but I definitely feel like in First Class, and in other superhero films, actually, to some degree, and I can argue, to some degree, Tim Burton's Batman, actually, to mm-hmm. some degree, is also that way. Maybe another reason why Frank doesn't like it is that you don't have a variation of that character. Any, like, I'll argue Mystique is nothing like either the earlier films or any comic book iteration in the First Class film. Like, she's nothing like that character. And I'm not saying that she's bad, or that she's, for being this character that she is now, or that's somehow a wrong mm-hmm. character to
yeah.
have.
I think the team definitely has that. What Pete's talking about, like you got the dynamics of the team right. But yeah, and I think Al may be right. Mystique is kind of like a whole new character in the films,
but
and it's just a good character.
Yeah, and I think her struggle, I think, reflects so perfectly the larger idea of the X-Men struggle.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think it ties back into that spirit, even though it's not the spirit of the character, it's the spirit of the X-Men. And I think that's perfect. Plus, I love me some Matthew Vaughn as director of First Class. He's a good
and
guy.
And he didn't... The thing is, they took a character like Mystique, who was before a pretty much of a blank slate.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know an awful lot about her background. We didn't know, you know, what made her tick. She was just this evil, sexy super spy who could turn into anybody.
Right.
And it took a giant swerve. I mean, it dealt with Professor Xavier's past in a way that conflicted with comic book canon.
Yeah.
But really, there wasn't that much that needed to be completely rewritten with Mystique. And quite frankly, it remains to be seen whether or not the events of the movies will eventually turn her into the character that we all knew from the comics before.
True.
I think it's possible. First
class. And, it's yeah. possible.
And you have to do
but it's not necessary.
Yeah. You have to do a lot of editing by default just because the comics get so ridiculous.
And now again, it's one of those cases where comic books now imitate the movies.
Right, right.
Because coming a lot closer to she was in the movies and in the comics.
And I think that's a pretty good way to start wrapping things up, because that's kind of the dark side, possibly, of mainstream, or of comic book movie success. Mm-hmm. Because
a little bit.
Then the stories that you loved and that were the sort of the birthing point of these movies end up getting changed, which is fine, but changed to be marched in line with mass marketed movies, maybe that's not as great. Honestly, I'd be okay if there were changed to match up with like a cult favorite movie, or you know, a movie that really got the concept of it right. But it gets a little gray and a little disturbing when you're saying, well, this movie made all the money in the world, so even though the characters aren't anywhere near where they were in the book, we're going to start switching the book over. I'm not quite sure about that. But we'll leave that up to you, our listeners, to decide and to angrily yell at us in the comments of this podcast post. But one thing before we go, we put this through the various fictional computers that exist in Non-Pro Studios, and we have determined, I think, the two most successful comic book movies of all time, according to our criteria. Are you ready to hear this, guys?
I am.
Feel free to yell about it.
I'm very curious.
No, do not actually yell. I have to say that to our hosts.
Okay.
All right. As a tie, the two most successful comic book movies of all time are The Dark Knight and The Avengers. Now, at first, you're like, oh, shock. And then almost immediately, like, yeah, that sounds about right. This doesn't seem really that exciting, but I think it does hit all our points, right?
It does.
So innovation, right? The fact that you could do a multi-film mix-up of all these characters and it works. That's the Avengers all over. Innovation. Can you do a Batman movie without referring to Batman in it, in the title? Can you make this genre of a realistic superhero? A realistic superhero. Think about that phrase. Very odd. Maybe not the first one to do it. I mean, Batman Begins started the process, but can you keep it moving forward? Innovation. Mainstream success. Both films made all the money in the universe.
They're the two highest grossing superhero movies.
Redeeming a franchise. You definitely have it with The Dark Knight in terms of bringing Batman back into a way that's universe so well accepted that it basically is what DC is trying to do with all its other properties. Make it Batman Begins. Make it superhero character Begins. And Marvel, which had a ring of good movies, but all leading up to this franchise universe building film. And Marvel, in case you were wondering, back in the day, was the joke production company for mm-hmm. comic book movies.
Yeah.
They made the Dolph Lundgren Punisher movie, which may be a cult favorite.
Why?
They made all the made-for-TV movies that never quite made it. They couldn't match the success of Superman or Batman.
Hey.
Roger Corman's Fantastic Four.
It's the best Fantastic Four film, actually.
Well, no, I disagree.
All due respect to Mr. Jackson.
Oh, there was a Nick Fury as well.
Yes.
Yes.
And David Hasselhoff is Nick Fury.
I would totally acknowledge David Hasselhoff showing up in an episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as Samuel Jackson's father.
God, Nick Fury Sr.
Yeah. And I think both movies, definitely got it right. They just showed those characters in the ideal light that the majority of fans liked. And I think those two films definitely, are the very top. Unfortunately, they are also in the most successful comic book movies of all time, which negates the entire premise of this podcast. You want to know what success is for comic book movies? Look at the numbers. Just look at the numbers. Yeah.
I don't know. To end on something really quick, though, I think if you make a good movie, a really good movie, the numbers will follow.
Yeah. True that. All right, thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Asin Mario, for your Superman theme remix, your metal version. Pretty damn badass. And for more crap like this, subscribe to non-productive.com.
Good night, everybody.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.